Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And today we're sort of the joint Texas-Oklahoma Appellate Law Podcast. We have virtually crossed over the Red River, and we have our friends from the Oklahoma Appeals Podcast here today. And so we're going to kind of talk with them about appellate practice in both of those different states. So let's kind of start with some introductions. So Jana, Gabe, you guys want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Sure. Thanks, Jody. My name is Jana Knott, and Gabe Bass is my co-host on Oklahoma Appeals, the podcast. And my background is I graduated undergrad at the University of Oklahoma in 2008. And I did law school at Oklahoma City University and graduated there in 2011. And from there, I went directly to the Oklahoma Supreme Court as a staff attorney, also known as a law clerk. So each of the nine justices on our court have two staff attorneys that work directly for each of them. And so as luck would have it, as I was coming out of law school, Justice Noma Gurich was appointed in February of 2011 to the Oklahoma Supreme Court, and I was able to get one of the positions as her staff attorney. So I stayed with her at the court for 7 years, and then in 2018, joined up with Gabe at Bass Law here in Oklahoma City, and I now have an appellate practice, and I also do some district court civil litigation.
All right. Well, I'm Gabe Bass, and thanks, Jody and Todd, for inviting us on. You really have legitimized our little effort here in Oklahoma by by recognizing us. So we appreciate that. Well, my background is I'm an Oklahoma kid, grew up in central Oklahoma. I went to OU for undergrad, a finance and accounting major. And then I started law school right after undergrad at the University of Southern California and got about halfway through and then took a year leave of absence to go work at a software startup. This would have been about 99, 2000. So that was the thing to do, right? So I took a year leave of absence that turned into two, that turned into me being a law school dropout. But I was eventually, after the tech stock market crashed in 2000, 2001, I thought it probably made some sense to finish this law degree that I was halfway through, and that would make my mom really proud and happy. So I went back to OU to finish my law degree and got a master's degree in information systems. So I was on a 5-year, two law school, multi-state law school plan. And then in law school, I grew up in a family full of lawyers. My dad is an attorney. We practice together now. My uncle, his brother, was a former partner of ours. So lots of cousins. So kind of grew up around the law business. Never really thought I would practice law, but kind of went to law school after undergrad as an easy thing to do. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So that's the direction I went. And then I kind of already covered my uneven path through law school. But in law school, after September 11th, I decided to join the Marine Corps. So I signed up January 2002. And then I had about 1 year of law school left at that time. So I went to Officer Candidate School this summer after my second year of law school, which was, I guess, really my fourth year, if you take count my time off in between. Went through that, finished Officer Candidate School, got commissioned, and then they put me in the reserves and allowed me to go back to OU and finish my law degree and my master's degree. And then I spent about the first 5 years of my life as a lawyer, as an active duty Marine, and I worked mostly in military justice, so tried courts-martial. Which was a great experience, kind of akin to going to work in the DA's office. Just a lot of, at that time, the Marine Corps was very busy. We had a lot of interesting things going on in the early and mid 2000s. And so we got to work on a lot of really interesting military justice issues, you know, war crimes, all kinds of crazy stuff. So a lot of trial experience. It was fantastic. I decided to leave active duty just because of the operational tempo, and I'd already had a new baby, and I'd already put my wife through enough moving around and the kind of unpredictable nature of the Marine Corps at that time in our world. Came back to Oklahoma City to join my dad and uncle and practicing law here. And I've been doing that ever since. Came back here in 2007. I've remained in the Marine Corps and spend anywhere from a few days to a few weeks to, you know, 7 or 8 months at a time going and doing Marine Corps things over the last 13, 14 years. So that's kind of how I get to today. My practice has always been mostly real estate, oil and gas, and estate and trust related, and representing closely held businesses. Pretty even mix of trial and transactional practice.
I understand where Jan is coming from and her appellate experience, and how do you not, you know, clerk for a state Supreme Court justice and fall in love with the practice just because you see what the possibilities are. But what I didn't really catch in that, Gabe, was how you got connected into appellate law as an interest. It's clear you bring sort of a different perspective to this with all of your varied background, but why do an appellate podcast?
For the same reason I've done about everything I've done in my life, which is I'm usually scratching my own itch. You know, I see something that I wish there was that doesn't exist, and then I don't have the good sense to leave well enough alone, and I go try to create it. we didn't have anything like this. I had listened to your podcast and just thought, well, that's neat. That would be really cool to have something like that for Oklahoma lawyers. And of course, with Jana doing a lot of appellate law, I had done some before Jana joined us. I'd been involved in a few appeals. I've muddled my way through. I definitely was glad to have her come bring her expertise to the operation. But probably like the rest of you and many of the listeners, I'm a frequent consumer of podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts and I enjoy them. And I was just kind of interested in what it would take to put one together. And this seemed like a good topic because I thought it would be a good service for Oklahoma lawyers. We try to read all the new cases in any way and stay on top of what's going on. So why not kind of get a little more bang out of that effort and reuse the information and the time. And I thought it would be a good way for Jana to promote her appellate practice. So here we are. I didn't realize how much time it was going to take either.
That's very familiar. I think we kind of got into it for a lot of the same reasons and came to some of the same realizations too. Once we really got started, I mean, it's kind of funny. We've only been doing this, I guess this is our 10 months and it seems like so much longer, but of course, 2020 also seems so much longer for so many reasons too. I guess one thing we may want to start out with, you know, on the substance of this is kind of talking a little bit about how Texas courts versus Oklahoma courts are structured. Texas, we have kind of like Oklahoma, we have a Supreme Court that handles civil jurisdiction. We have a Court of Criminal Appeals that's the highest criminal jurisdiction. And then in between that, we've got 14 intermediate courts of appeals that are all divided into different geographic regions. And then we've got all sorts of crazy different trial court permutations. And so that's kind of what ours looks like. But our courts of appeals, the intermediates, have both criminal and civil jurisdiction. And so that's kind of generally how ours is set up. Oklahoma is similar, but also a little bit different. You guys want to kind of tell us how that works?
Sure. So we do have our Oklahoma Supreme Court, which is the highest court in the state, and which is the court that constitutionally does have superintending power over all other courts, including the Court of Criminal Appeals, as it relates to any jurisdictional disputes between the Oklahoma Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. So if there's a dispute about who has appellate jurisdiction in a case, then the Oklahoma Supreme Court gets to make that decision. So our Court of Civil Appeals only has civil jurisdiction. So that's a difference from Texas. So we just have 4 divisions of our Court of Civil Appeals, and I would say a high percentage of our appeals that get filed at the Oklahoma Supreme Court are assigned back to our Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals. And so that's where really the majority of the appellate decisions are coming from in Oklahoma.
When you say division, Jana, do they actually all sit in one location, the Court of Civil Appeals, or are they distributed throughout the state?
The Court of Civil Appeals has an office in Oklahoma City and an office in Tulsa. And in both of those locations, they have courtrooms and offices and And so two divisions sit in each location, and they are geographically appointed, if that makes sense. So you do have to be in a certain area in order to apply for an open seat on the Court of Civil Appeals, for instance, or at least have moved there by the time you're appointed. So just two locations where all four of them are located.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Is your Oklahoma Supreme Court done by geographic district as well, or is it all at large?
It's also done by geographic location. The legislature has recently done a little bit of tweaking on that because for a very long time, it was based on our old congressional districts. And so I can't remember when it's going into effect, but I think it was last year. We do have some at-large positions now, but historically that has not been the case. That's a recent creation. So
are your judges appointed, elected, both? How do y'all do judge selection?
So our appellate court judges, the Oklahoma Supreme Court, Court of Criminal Appeals, and Court of Civil Appeals are all appointed by the governor. And so we have what's called the Judicial Nominating Commission. And so when there's a vacancy, applicants apply to that commission and go through background investigations and interviews. And the commission then submits three names to our governor. And then he or she makes the selection to that vacancy. And then each of the judges on the appellate court sit for a retention ballot every 6 years. So it's just a yes or no, do you want this judge or justice to be retained? And we've never not had anyone be retained. So, I mean, it's in effect, it's a lifetime appointment unless, you know, at least for now, historically. So,
yeah, there's been historically very little political interest in the retention ballots. A couple of election cycles ago, the state chamber kind of dipped their toe in that water and tried to put out some judicial rankings and tried to kind of drag in a political direction, but they didn't really have any success with that. And there hasn't been any energy behind that effort the last few times there have been judges on the retention ballot. I think it's worth saying a little more about our Judicial Nominating Commission, as it's an interesting creation. It's the result of reform following some bribery scandals on our Oklahoma Supreme Court decades ago, and that's when this system was implemented. And the Judicial Nominating Commission is actually made up of a majority of laypersons. They're appointed from different authorities. We actually did a whole episode on our podcast about the Judicial Nominating Commission and how it works. But the rules are such that you can't be even related to a lawyer if you're on one of the layperson positions on the commission. They have to have basically an even weighting of political affiliation. So they've structurally tried to make it as apolitical as possible. And it seems to work pretty well so far. Now, our district court judges are still elected by a nonpartisan election. But as a practical matter, many of them are also appointed because if an elected judge retires or leaves the bench, dies during their term, then the Judicial Nominating Commission process is used to submit three names to the governor for the governor to appoint their replacement. So we don't really have, even though they are elected positions at the trial court level, when I say district court, that's our trial court level. While they are technically elected, it's pretty unusual to have a contested election, especially in the smaller counties, for obvious reasons. Not many lawyers are that motivated to run against their sitting judge with the threat of losing. And that can be a little uncomfortable because some of these counties, you know, they don't have a lot of lawyers in them. Some of our remote counties. Now you will see more contested elections in Oklahoma County and Tulsa County, but for the other 75 counties in the state, it's pretty much rare to have a contested judicial election for trial court.
That is a very interesting contrast to Texas, where from the Justice of the Peace Small Claims Court all the way to the Texas Supreme Court. Every bench is elected in a partisan election. And there are appointments, but typically the appointment is just sort of like you were talking about, when somebody retires before their term is up or leaves office, the governor gets to appoint them, but then they have to stand for a partisan election next time around. So it really, as far in one direction as your system goes towards nonpartisanship, I think ours skews pretty much the opposite direction towards a partisan system. Although there's been a lot of talk in the last couple of years about reforming it, and our legislature is in its biennial session right now, and that's kind of one of the agenda items. It'll be interesting to see what, if anything, comes of that.
We've had a selection commission that's been studying the issue. Of course, this happens with some frequency. It always depends on what the election looked like for the party historically in power in recent times. And sometimes when it doesn't go the way that people think it should, there's a kind of a big flurry to study the way that we pick our judges. But that is an issue that's being discussed currently. And the kinds of models that we kind of covered here have been looked at extensively. And so it'll be interesting to see if our legislature, you know, if there's any traction that comes out of that. But I don't know if they're looking at the kind of model where the appellate judges only, rather than the trial judges, would be subject to an appointment. That's interesting to me because that's one of the knocks on election of appellate judges is qualification, for one thing, because it's really, as much as they try to take the politics out of the office, and I think so many of them do that and do it well, at the end of the day, you know, you just meet the bare constitutional qualifications, get your name on the ballot, and if the political tide is running a certain way, you're a six-year appellate justice at a minimum. So it does create some strange developments in our civil and criminal justice system to have the system we have. So it's interesting to hear about what you guys do up there.
Are your Supreme Court justices, for instance, how often do they sit for election?
We have nine, and they each serve a six-year term, but they've got them staggered. So every couple of years, some members of the court are up. But for a while, we had a pretty, pretty consistent court. There was a long time where there was just a lot of turnover in a very quick period. And then there was a period of about 8 or 10 years where we had a pretty consistent court where nobody turned over. And then in the last couple of years, it's kind of started turning over again with retirements and stuff. So there's a lot of different movement where people may be on the ballot at a time they wouldn't have been before. So it's definitely a different system than Oklahoma, where you kind of talked about a lifetime appointment. I think particularly our Texas Supreme Court, for a lot of different reasons, has pretty historically, at least in the last 25 years, turned over seats with pretty regular frequency.
There's not a lot of Texas Supreme Court justices that fill multiple terms. Be elected three times, it's 18 years. That would be a really long time for a Texas Supreme Court justice to serve. I don't want to describe that office as a stepping stone, but there's certainly been former Supreme Court justices who have attained other positions. One went on to become, actually two went on to become an attorney general of the state. We've had several now that have gone from that to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. You know, another
governor, senator.
Yep, the same ones that were AGs went on to become our current governor and one of our two current senators. But you can see how the political element of it kind of fits in. They have the advantage of learning how to operate, even though they're lawyers and judges in the political system, and then are able to take that and sort of propel themselves, for want of a better word.
I can't think of any instance where one of our appellate judges in Oklahoma had a post-bench political career. I can't think of any. I'm not saying there hasn't been, but, and I think it's not uncommon for our Supreme Court justices to serve 30-year plus. And we've had some recent turnover, but like our senior justice now, Justice Cogger, I think was put on the bench in 82.
Yeah, and we just heard this week we had announced a retirement. Justice Colbert is our first African-American justice on the court. And I mean, he's been on the court for, I think, 20 years. He was on the Court of Civil Appeals before he went to the Supreme Court. So, I mean, he's had a long tenure as well. So
that's interesting.
I would say several there are 20-year plus. I mean, I think of Justice Winchester, Justice Edmondson, Justice Reeve, who recently retired, but was there a long time. So
that is very interesting. And I guess what that also produces is a court that, looking at the snapshot of it, is probably older than, say, our court. We've kind of paralleled what you see in the federal appointment system, where we've had kind of a youth movement, as you might call it, on our court. When you've been practicing law 25 years and some of the Supreme Court justices are younger than you, which is now happening to me, or your peers get elected, which that happened to me too. But it's an interesting thing to watch, you know.
I can't think of any of our current justices. I don't think any of them came directly from private practice. They've all come from either the trial court or the Court of Civil Appeals. So I don't know if is it common in Texas that someone goes from private practice directly to an appellate court, or do most of them have trial court experience?
You know, I think it varies depending on where you are. I think in the smaller appellate court districts, it seems like it's more common, I think just anecdotally, for a trial court judge to move up to the Court of Appeals, either by appointment or election. I think in the urban districts like Houston, Dallas, Austin, you see a lot more people getting straight from private practice to the bench. I think in the smaller places, it makes sense because you kind of have that political profile as maybe the district judge or a DA or something like that to move up to the appellate court. So I think you see it more there than you do. Although it just kind of depends. You know, a lot of our judges on the appellate court levels, I think in particular, both intermediate and Supreme Court, kind of time leaving the bench sometimes to give the governor's office an appointment. And so sometimes that paves the way for them to pull somebody out of private practice and appoint them and then give them kind of a little boost to get hit the ground running to keep that bench.
Just to add quickly to that, some of the appointments in the last, whenever there's been a vacancy on the Supreme Court, there's sort of a trend to appoint, to fill the unexpired terms, someone who had been in the governor's office working in the executive branch with super good credentials, you know, nothing that doesn't pass muster that way. But also we've had some recent sweeps in elections that have resulted in some good judges being removed from office in some of the intermediate courts. And the last few appointments we've seen a lot of those folks who were long-standing appellate judges had been, you know, had run elections many times and just unfortunately just got caught in a wave. The governor seemed fit to fill the unexpired terms, the last couple of benches, with those folks and who are now going to be running statewide offices. So it has been a mix. There's a few, sometimes private practice, but as Jody says, it kind of depends on the court and the area of the state.
And did I understand you correctly to say that your intermediate appellate courts, the criminal and civil, are combined? They hear both types of cases?
Yep. Everything except for death penalty. Death penalty case, well, there may be some other limited exceptions, but that's the big one I can think of. Death penalty cases go straight from the trial court to the Court of Criminal Appeals. But I think for the most part, 99% of everything else goes through the intermediate courts. And that's actually kind of a good transition maybe into our next topic, is kind of talking about how appeals are initiated in both states. And I know that they're a little bit different. I've done just enough appellate work in Oklahoma to be dangerous to myself. But in Texas, from whatever trial court you come from, for the most part, you file your notice of appeal in the trial court and you're going to go to the intermediate appellate court, whether civil or criminal, for the geographic area where you are, except in Houston, where they have two different appellate courts with the same jurisdiction and you just kind of roll the dice onto which one you're going to end up in front of. But you do that, and then it takes you straight up to that court, and they're going to hear your case. They don't have discretion to do anything else with it. They're going to hear your case. Some limited exceptions for, like, the Austin Court of Appeals has some jurisdiction over some statewide stuff because it's based in the capital. And so that's where it goes. And then however they decide from there, your only real next step is to seek discretionary review on the criminal side, either in the Court of Criminal Appeals or on the civil side, to the Texas Supreme Court. So everything goes through the filter of the intermediate courts first, no matter what. But I understand it's a little bit different in Oklahoma.
Yeah. So when you file your appeal, at least on the civil side, there's no notice of appeal that's filed in the trial court. You file your appeal directly with the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And then at that point, the Oklahoma Supreme Court sort of takes the reins on getting the case worked up, essentially getting the record from the trial court. The briefs are all filed at the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And then once all of that is finished and the briefing cycle is completed, then I would say probably 85 to 90% of the appeals are then assigned back to one of the four divisions of the Court of Civil Appeals. So the Supreme Court does have the opportunity before it assigns and even after it assigns in some cases to retain the case, retain the appeal, and make the first instant decision. And parties can ask for the court to retain the case before it's assigned to the Court of Civil Appeals. So that does happen occasionally. You've got to have a pretty salty legal issue to get any traction on your motion to retain, because the overwhelming majority of cases are sent back to the Court of Civil Appeals for a first decision. So then once the Court of Civil Appeals issues their opinion, then the parties have the opportunity to seek cert with the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And that, of course, is a discretionary decision. Unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, where it's a 4-vote to take cert, ours is a 5-vote to take cert on a case. So I don't know the percentages off the top of my head. Those things are not easily tracked in Oklahoma because of we don't have electronic filing yet, for instance, and our state court database is not easily searchable, I would say. So I think it's probably about 10 to 15% of the cases that go up on cert are actually taken. And that just from experience, the majority of them, they don't review those. So the Court of Criminal Appeals side of things, which I don't do any criminal appellate work, but I do know that it's similar to what you said, that there is a notice of appeal filed in the trial court first. And then that is actually the appeals filed in the Court of Criminal Appeals, and they don't have an intermediate criminal court. So they have a very heavy workload at the Court of Criminal Appeals because they're taking everything. Now they do have more staff attorneys that sort of do a first look at everything so that they can weed out some of the procedural cases that have issues and that kind of thing. So that's typically how it works. Now, if we're talking about an original proceeding. So our Oklahoma Supreme Court has original jurisdiction to hear cases, and there's not really, I would say, a limit on what they can hear. Obviously, it's discretionary as well. So you typically initiate those proceedings by filing an application to assume original jurisdiction. And you get a brief with that, and you make your arguments as to why the court should assume jurisdiction. And then if they do, then they'll either grant relief or deny relief. So those can come from the district courts. It could be a discovery issue that you don't have an immediately appealable order on. And so one of the parties seeks a writ through an application to assume original jurisdiction. We've got some very specific areas of the law where the legislature has given the Oklahoma Supreme Court original jurisdiction to hear challenges to certain things. So one example is the initiative petition process in Oklahoma. When an organization seeks to put a state question on the ballot, that's heavily based in statute, and any challenge to that state question is brought in the first instance in the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And so that's where they would exercise their original jurisdiction. A lot of cases where there's a public policy issue or interpretation of a statute that's been recently passed, in recent years, budget issues with the legislature, a lot of times those things will end up in the Supreme Court first in their original jurisdiction docket. And so that's typically the types of cases that you're going to see published opinions in coming from the court's original jurisdiction.
Does the Supreme Court issue some unpublished opinions then?
The Supreme Court issues unpublished orders. Most of the things that come from the Supreme Court, if it's a case that's pending there, it is typically a published opinion. But like, for instance, those writs that I was talking about that come from the district courts on discovery disputes or things like that, a lot of those are unpublished, even if they grant relief. And so a lot of times you only know about those if you happen to know the lawyer that's on the case or, you know to look for it. And so we occasionally will get some conflicting decisions, not from the court, but from the Court of Civil Appeals, and then an unpublished writ that was issued that helped us make an argument as to why the court should take a case and issue a published opinion.
It's interesting.
What about the unpublished opinion situation in your intermediate appellate court? Are all their opinions published or unpublished, or are they just some are, some aren't?
There used to be a really significant distinction between unpublished and published opinions, and it was a cause of some concern among appellate advocates because unpublished opinions couldn't be used as authority. And of course, you're researching a case on sort of a maybe a semi-novel issue, and you find the the unpublished opinion from another court or even from your court you're appearing in that just, you know, is on all fours with your facts or whatever. But, and that actually got to be quite a problem. And so the Supreme Court, many years ago now, did away with the distinction in terms of the authoritativeness of unpublished versus published opinions. In fact, it did away with unpublished opinions altogether. There's no such thing any longer as an unpublished opinion. What you have is a memorandum opinion, which is not published in the Southwestern Reporter, and an opinion which is published in the Southwestern Reporter. And so see a lot of cases. We cite a lot of memorandum opinions to Westlaw or Lexis, but they now, since 2003, they carry the same authoritative weight as something that's published in the Reporter. So it's made our job a lot easier in terms of researching and finding cases that have the weight of authority. But there are a few lawyers who still sometimes get the designations confused, or who will refer to unpublished opinions when that's really kind of now an archaic term in our jurisprudence.
Our Supreme Court doesn't do unpublished opinions. Everything, they're a little bit different because pretty much everything comes to them on discretionary review. But with the exception of mandamus, which is kind of akin to, I think, some of the original proceedings that you talked about, or a per curiam opinion where you have six judges that agree to correct an error in just a written opinion, everything the Supreme Court takes gets oral argument typically, and then is decided with a written published opinion. And so except in those other instances, sometimes they'll do it without oral argument. So everything that comes from them is always published.
And I think the rate of the Supreme Court taking cases is actually in line with what I think I heard Janice say earlier, which was around 15% or so. Our Supreme Court decides, we've got some folks that keep track of these statistics in ways that I really can't hardly get my mind around, because everybody wants to know, you know, what are my chances, right? And for many, many years, the percentage of grants has hovered between 10, 12, 13%. So it does give you something to go on when you're advising your clients about what your chances are if you're dealing with something that is a discretionary jurisdiction issue, which in our Supreme Court is 100% of the cases. So it's interesting.
And that number in Oklahoma of the number of cert petitions granted is hard to put your finger on, because in cases where cert is not granted, so there's no resulting, you know, published opinion, then you don't know that what's been petitioned for, what's been granted, what's not, because the court doesn't publish their just day-to-day orders of granting or denying. Unless you happen to be in the case or following the docket, you know, you don't know what they've turned down. And Jan and I are looking at ways to try to glean a little better insight into that information so people can know, like, what are my chances? Particularly, you know, what issues have they granted cert on that we're just awaiting a decision on? Because that could be of interest to folks. You know, if you've got an issue you're thinking about appealing, or you're getting ready to take the trial, it might be nice to know if the court has recently granted cert on an issue that is important in your case, and you're just awaiting a decision. It may impact how you, your timeline at the trial court, how, if you want to push things along or you want to slow it down and see what they do. So we're trying to figure out a way to harness the data there and make that information a little more transparent to the bar.
I was just going to touch back on that, kind of piggybacks on the unpublished decisions from the Court of Civil Appeals, where even as recently as this week, we are having issues about whether to cite to unpublished Court of Civil Appeals opinions in our briefs at the district court and even on appeal. So our Supreme Court, like you mentioned, Todd, still currently has a rule that says you cannot cite to unpublished Court of Civil Appeals opinions in any brief to any court in the state. And so I completely agree, am in favor of using unpublished opinions, because like you said, a lot of times you've got a case that's unpublished, but it's directly on point. And if nothing else, it at least gives your district court judge or even your appellate court judges some guidance. They know it's there. It's not precedential necessarily, but it does give them at least a starting point analytically a lot of times. And so I would like to be able to cite to those and say, here's this case, or this is what this panel did on the Court of Civil Appeals. But currently, the database that used to collect those is no longer online. And so the Supreme Court's reasoning for that rule is that these opinions are not widely available for practitioners to search and locate, is the reasoning behind the rule. So there has to be something, we have to deal with the database portion of it, I think, before we can make any movement toward any type of a rule change in that regard. So I won't talk about our pending case, but as like I said, I mean, we were asked this week from a district court judge, is there any unpublished Court of Civil Appeals opinions on this issue? And it's like, well, yeah, judge, but I can't cite to those. So it's like, but if you're going to consider them, what do we do? You know, so it's an interesting conundrum, but it sounds like you guys went through that 15, 20 years ago. So
I think Oklahoma needs to address it, and interested to look at the details of how Texas addressed it as a model to suggest, because what happens is the judges go look for themselves and they find these unpublished opinions and they're taking them into consideration. But because you can't cite to them in your brief, you don't get the opportunity to distinguish them or make sure they find the ones you think matter. And as far as authority in Oklahoma, published or unpublished, the Court of Civil Appeals opinions are persuasive only. So
yeah, I should clarify to something related to that is the pre-2003 unpublished opinions are still unpublished opinions. They're not, they didn't get elevated to memorandum opinion status. And so we do, you know, occasionally you will see people reaching back beyond 2003 and you still have to cite those as being not designated for publication. And the rule, our rule, you should take a look at our rule, Gabe, if you're looking to try and advocate for some change in Oklahoma, because I think it handles it well in that the rule does specifically say that pre-2003 cases, and it's a date in 2003, I can't recall the exact date, but before that date, they are unpublished, but they can be treated as persuasive authority. And so if a court has set out its reasoning for deciding a case based on a certain set of facts, you can present that to any judge throughout the state and cite it. The weight of authority may be a little questionable, but it's there. Because that's what you're describing, which I've described as a situation kind of like what we used to have before 03, when you just, if someone cited an unpublished opinion that therefore couldn't be authoritative, the other side would squawk about it and the judges wouldn't necessarily follow it. Well, that's just an unpublished opinion. Well, I think our courts have done a good job, and this was a rule change that really drove this, in making the law available publicly. And Westlaw and Lexis receive those opinions from the courts directly. And so we don't have an issue with there being some hidden decisions that I think is something that goes way beyond Oklahoma. I think the federal systems have experienced this quite a bit too, and they have their own unpublished opinion rules. So gosh, it's hard to imagine not knowing what the Supreme Court has been up to in deciding certain cases. You know, like that's a different kind of shadow docket, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, yeah, that was going back to one of the reasons we started this podcast. It's like you guys say in your intro, it's like pulling back the curtain on some of these issues. And if there's a way that we can start sort of tracking some of these things and keeping lawyers in the know on what issues are pending and what's coming out. But part of it is that the Supreme Court itself has to be willing to publish their order sheets that come from their weekly conference. And that's just not been the case historically. So stay tuned on that. We'll see if anything comes of it. So
for most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Are y'all doing much jury card practice in Oklahoma? Tell us a little bit about how that works.
So we have the Oklahoma Uniform Jury Instructions, and typically what happens is once you are getting close to your trial date, you submit written proposed jury instructions to the trial judge, and there usually is some type of a conference with the trial judge to go through those. I would say that and it's actually statutory in Oklahoma, if there is a civil or criminal uniform jury instruction that is available for your case, the statute mandates that you use that in the case. So the Oklahoma Supreme Court has a commission for the proposed jury instructions. And so they go through all of these and look at them and propose new ones and make amendments based on changes in the law. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court administratively approves those, but they do not substantively say anything about any of those jury instructions with regard to whether that actually is the law. So in those jury instruction conferences with your trial judge, if you think that the uniform jury instruction is not what the law is, of course, you've got to make your record on it and bring that up as an appealable issue. But decisions where our appellate courts have said that the uniform jury instruction is not the law are very, very few and far between. So I would say most of the appellate issues that come up with jury instructions are when there's not a uniform jury instruction that's directly on point and parties are proposing special instructions to the trial court based on specific facts of the case or an area of the law where the issue's not been drilled down to a jury instruction. So that's kind of how it goes in Oklahoma state courts. I don't know if Gabe has anything to add to that with his more trial lawyer background. So
not too much. I think it works as you described. Typically after the defendant has rested their case, the judge will say, okay, tomorrow morning, you guys bring me in your proposed jury instructions or send it to my bailiff in Word format. And we'll go through them and argue about any ones that, you know, one side wants or the other side doesn't want. And I'll decide which instructions I'm going to give, and then we're going to give them. And I think it's not an issue that we see bubbling up to our appellate courts very often. Between our Court of Civil Appeals and our Supreme Court, there was maybe 120, 130 published opinions in 2020. And maybe one of them had something to do with an error in a jury instruction. So we seem to do a fairly good job of it, primarily because of the uniform nature of the jury instructions. There's not a lot of freelancing that goes on. There's pretty much a uniform jury instruction for about everything. So it makes it harder to screw up.
Well, Jody, that's a pretty big contrast.
Yeah, that was one of the things I definitely wanted to talk about, because our charge practice is appellate lawyer bread and butter. I mean, that so many issues and so many cases come from it. We don't have uniform instructions. We have what are called pattern jury charges, but they're not required. They're not really approved by the Supreme Court. And in fact, our Supreme Court really has no problem knocking down a pattern jury charge or instruction that they don't like. So if there is one on point, generally a court is going to give it. But there have been times when I know I have, probably Todd has, and most appellate lawyers have had to argue against a pattern jury charge instruction for not accurately stating the law. And then there's all sorts of weird procedural issues that come up with the charge separate and apart from the substance of the law that create issues. So, I mean, I don't have a number, but we have a lot of charge error issues that come up in Texas.
It's one of the very ripe areas for, if you're the appellant, that's one of the first things you want to do if you've lost at trial, is take a close look coming in as appellate counsel at the jury charge and see what you want to know, what error was preserved, and you can advise the client then, you know, all right, I think you've got a decent issue here or not, based on your understanding of the law. We have a pattern jury charge committee, actually several of them. They're standing committees through the state bar that are appointed by the state bar president. And it's basically literally just committee work on, you build off what others have done, but they're updated regularly. I think there's the publication cycles every 2 years for each volume. And there's healthy debate in those rooms. I happen to sit on one of those committees, and it's interesting to talk with a bunch of other lawyers from all kinds of different perspectives about what the law is and how the jury ought to be instructed. But the charge is not, or the task is not to, you know, write a law review article that settles all these issues. You basically have to be flexible and malleable to, you know, what the law is doing. And of course, you've got to take into consideration cases that have been decided on those issues in recent Supreme Court decisions. And it is quite interesting. I don't think I really appreciated when I first started doing this kind of work, just how involved that part of jury trials can be in our state.
Well, I guess that brings up a question too, is the practice that Jan and I have, as far as the trial court practice, many of our issues are bench issues. So I'm just curious about the difference between Oklahoma and Texas and what entitles you to a jury in Texas.
For the most part, honestly, you pay a fee. Just about any kind of factual dispute can go to a jury, broadly speaking. Now, there are things like interpretation of a contract is initially a matter for the trial court. There are some situations when you can get into contract interpretation for the jury, but that's kind of, there are a lot of things that are sort of gateway legal issues that the trial court has to decide in the first instance. But if there's fact issues, if there's ambiguity in a contract, that kind of stuff can go to a jury. So we have a very robust right to jury trial here. And so a lot of stuff gets tried. Now, that's not to say that trial lawyers and appellate lawyers don't spend a lot of time arguing that as a matter of law, there's no issue here that needs to go to the jury. And we have a lot of different procedural avenues to go to that. So a lot of stuff gets disposed long before it ever goes to a jury trial. But Texas does have a very robust jury trial right. And so there's a lot of stuff that ends up in front of a jury that probably in other states might not.
Well, I'd say in Oklahoma, I mean, if you have a claim for money damages, you're basically going to have the right to a jury. So all of our, you know, all the tort practice, all the plaintiffs type stuff is certainly going to be jury trial eligible. But, you know, in the estate and trust world where I do a lot of my work, you're not entitled to a jury. So if it's a probate contest, if it's construction of a trust, you know, that kind of thing, that's all bench. So even our appellate work that we've done in the last couple of years, a lot of it has been appeals coming up from bench trials.
Yeah. I mean, like trust construction, that kind of stuff, I think would probably get decided by the bench. But in probate, things like undue influence capacity, that kind of stuff, that's stuff that can end up in front of a jury and often does.
And not here. That we, in fact, Jan and I tried a bench trial on undue influence and capacity on a, in a will contest last summer. I guess it's been 2 summers ago now. 2019.
Yeah. You were gone in 2020, if you'll recall.
I do recall. So that's a big difference then, because anything probate related is going to be a bench trial in Oklahoma. It's an equitable court. Probate court's an equitable court in Oklahoma, and you're not getting a jury.
That's interesting.
And a lot of my, I say a lot of them, but a number of my appeals, I do a lot of oil and gas appeals. And so those quiet title cases, a lot of those issues are equitable. And so they come up from a bench trial. And so I don't know that I'm in my third year out of being at the court in private practice. And I've yet to see, I don't think I've had a jury trial appeal yet. All of my appeals are coming from bench trials or interlocutory orders that are ripe for appeal, things like that. So
I wonder with the differences in the way jury trials are handled up there. I mean, we've just been crippled by the pandemic in terms of moving cases along. And I mean, we've got such a strong tradition of trying jury cases, and the numbers are just staggering as far as what our backlog has been. Are y'all able to move cases along through bench trials through Zoom, or how's it been going up there?
We have not. It's gone by basically district by district, judge by judge, frankly. And a lot of our judges are nervous about virtual hearings, I think. Now, there are a handful of them that are moving things along with virtual hearings. Gabe, you may know, but I'm not aware of any bench trials taking place virtually at this point. So,
yeah, I think it's been limited to pretrial matters, motions and non-evidentiary issues, summary judgments and motions to compel and that kind of thing.
There's definitely a backlog. I mean, there's definitely a backlog right now as far as if we have a civil case. We've got a couple that we are even bench trials. The judges are backlogged with the criminal felony cases and then the civil jury trials. They have weeks that they set aside for jury trials. And so we sort of fall in behind those if we are just asking for a bench trial. And so we are seeing a little bit of backlog in that regard.
What about on the appellate side? You know, my limited experience in Oklahoma appellate courts was that a lot of cases don't get argued. A lot of it's decided on the briefing. I guess number one, is that correct? And number two, has there been a move toward virtual oral arguments as the pandemic has gone on?
That is correct, that most cases in Oklahoma are decided on the briefs.
It's an most is an understatement.
I would say that the Oklahoma Supreme Court in a regular year in the last 10 to 15 years has at most 3 to 5 oral arguments per year. The Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals, probably the same or less than that. I think the Court of Criminal Appeals does hold oral argument more frequently, especially on some of the more high profile case. And I think they set those dockets regularly each month. But as far as the civil side of things, you know, few and far between. So to answer your second question, no, there has not been any type of movement toward a virtual oral argument in Oklahoma. So
now we did have one of the Supreme Court referees on the podcast a month or so ago. And I think they have been making a little more use of telephonic and virtual hearings on their matters that the referees handle for the court. So, you know, preliminary stuff.
But certainly not the nine justices in a virtual setting like you're seeing with a lot of the appellate courts around the country.
We have a hard time getting, well, we actually have not so far had our oral arguments at the Supreme Court even archived for purposes of listening to later or watching. They did over the last few years start streaming them in real time, but it's not like you can go to, I mean, unless someone has gone through the effort to capture that live stream and archive it, the court doesn't do that. So there's no way to go back and watch oral arguments, which is astounding, really.
Yeah. You'll have a recognized specialty in appellate law, either on the criminal or civil side in Oklahoma?
Oklahoma does not have recognized specialties, period, full stop.
I mean, that's not unusual for states not to do that. You know, us and Florida and California are among the top three that do that. There may be a few others, but those are the jurisdictions I'm familiar with. But I was just thinking, with so few cases being argued, how does a lawyer without substantial experience get the experience they need to be perceived as a good oral advocate?
That's a great question, Todd. That's a great question.
Jana and I argued a case, but I don't know how great we were because we didn't win.
That's right. Yeah. So.
But it was close. It was 5-4.
Well, you may have been fantastic. You just may have been on the, you know,
the losing side of the issue. Right. Yeah.
Well, we can represent that we were fantastic because there's no record of it for anybody to prove us wrong.
That's exactly right. It's tough. I will say that there are only a handful, less than 5 practitioners here in the state who practice in what I would call the initiative petition world and or state constitutional world that have had multiple oral arguments at our Oklahoma Supreme Court. And that's because those types of cases are what they typically will grant oral argument in. And so, but even those practitioners, we're looking at only maybe 5 to 7, at least in my recent memory, where you're seeing the same advocates on certain issues. I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult to be able to get that experience. At this point, it's like try to argue as many motions in the trial court as you can, you know, and just know that if it goes up on appeal, you're going to have 3 asking you questions or 9. And so I've seen enough of them to be familiar with what goes on. But for somebody who's got an appeal and they've really not done many appeals, but then all of a sudden the Supreme Court grants their oral argument, I mean, I can imagine what you might feel like.
Well, it happens here too.
Yeah.
Well, does that make you want to gravitate more to, say, federal work so you can get arguments in the 10th Circuit? What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think eventually that's part of what, you know, I would like to do in building my practice. But of course, as you guys know, that takes time. And so part of the hurdle is always breaking into that area and convincing those trial lawyers that they need to bring you in on a case. And so I think part of it will take time for me to build that part of my practice. So,
well, starting a podcast is a good way to get people to know who you are and your interest in developing an appellate practice. I think that's great. Y'all have taken, I've noticed, a little different approach than we have. And we tend to get on here and Jody and I will get a guest on and we'll sort of pontificate about a specific topic or about that person's particular experience or background. And it seems like y'all are doing a lot of sort of substantive case analysis, being sort of the reporters for lawyers who are interested in cases coming out of those appellate courts.
Yeah, we kind of are taking a blend. I mean, we've done a series of interviews of district court judges. So we've got 4 or 5 judges that we're going to interview. Some we've already, we just published the first one on Wednesday and we have 4 or 5 lined up. And it's kind of a sampling of small counties, big counties across the state. So we're doing that. But yeah, we also have been doing the appellate case update episodes, trying to at least say a few things, sometimes probably too many things, about all of the published opinions that come out from the Court of Civil Appeals and the Supreme Court. And I'd certainly be interested to hear if you all have had requests for that. We have gotten good feedback for that. People tend to say they like that because they get their bar journal with those cases in them, but they stack up, right? It's not something that you just sit down and most practitioners sit down and read all the new cases. So they like the fact that they can, on their drive into work or when they're on the treadmill or whatever, they can listen and get a 3 to 5 to 7. We try to keep it shorter than we are
10, whenever 15, successful. Depending on
to get a little, you know, in audio format, here's a case that came out and you know, maybe it's something of interest to them in their practice. Maybe it's not, but I think so far we're encouraged to continue to do both styles of interview as well as case updates and talk about the case. And we typically will say where the case came from, how it got to the court that has issued the opinion that we're talking about, cover the facts briefly, the court's analysis, what the outcome was, if there were dissents or any other quirky things about it, like the court issued an order to the party to refile their briefs in the correct bounded format or you know, just weird things like that. We try to touch on administrivia and trivia, I guess.
And one of the things too, when we were talking about kind of how we wanted to set those episodes up, spending 7 years in the court system in Oklahoma, I interacted frequently with trial judges in Oklahoma, just at different judicial conferences and things like that. And our trial judges don't have law clerks. And so for me, this is a way to provide them some research that's quick and easy to be able to do, like Gabe said, when they're driving in or if they've got a break or whatever, and it's not necessarily pulling all the cases from the website and having to read any of them. They can listen, and if there's something that they think affects any cases that they have currently pending before them, then they can go pull it and take a deeper look at it. But just as a way to provide them with a little bit of assistance on some of that legal research, I know is something I heard frequently about. So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It gives you a pretty good motivation to stay on top of those cases as they come out. And you get that little pressure of, oh, well, I've got a report on this. We've got to digest these cases. And it actually will benefit you tremendously in your practice to do that. We never even considered doing case updates on this show. And maybe it's in part because the staff attorney for public information at the Supreme Court issues opinion summaries every Friday when the opinions come out. And then there seems like there's always someone who's already providing summaries of cases. And so when I used to write a lot of blog posts, I started off doing case summaries and I thought to myself, this is a lot of work and someone else is already doing it. And so I was kind of questioning the value in doing it in that format at the time, but you're offering something completely different with the 5 or 10 minute synopsis of a case that someone can listen to on the treadmill. I think there's definitely value in that.
Well, and I think our other problem is just the amount, keeping up with it, because the Texas Supreme Court is not so hard to follow, but the intermediate courts of appeals, I mean, yikes.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a consideration for you all. Our Court of Civil Appeals, I can't remember, Gabe, how many they issued this last year.
Yeah.
But
I think they issued about the same number as far as published opinions as the Supreme Court, you know, as far as substantive cases, 60-ish. Now, the Supreme Court issues a bunch more stuff because they, like all the bar discipline is issued as a published opinion and their administrative orders and things. But as far as true case decisions, about 60, I think.
Yeah, this last year was 48 for the Oklahoma Supreme Court. I just did a presentation on that this week. So those we can keep up with fairly quickly. And Court of Civil Appeals we did this year. We'll see how it goes here in 2021. So
you know, we may have to be a little more discerning and, you know, just because it is published, we may not need to talk about it. And in some cases we have just said, this is about expungements. If you practice in that area, you might want to have a look at it, but we don't need to talk about it for 10 minutes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Sure.
We've covered a lot of stuff. Is there anything else you guys want to cover before we kind of wrap up here or?
Well, I guess I'd be curious to know, and our listeners might want to know your background, if we're going to release this on our feed as well, you know, what's your background and how you guys decided to take on this endeavor of a podcast, and how how often you put out episodes. We try to say every other Wednesday, and we've been able to keep up with that pace so far. But I don't know how often you all are trying to do it.
You guys are cranking them out, though. I mean,
we have cranked them out. Jody, you can tell the origin story and I'll chime in. You tell it better than I do.
Okay. So I guess about me, I am in my 15th year at Kelly Hart and Hallman, which is a firm that's based in Fort Worth. And I do primarily appellate practice. I mean, I do civil litigation as well. And it varies month to month what that looks like, whether it's working on actual appeals or working in the trial court on legal issues, appellate issues, or sometimes just straight litigation. So that's what I do. In terms of the podcast, it kind of started with a joke on Twitter, actually. I made a joke about starting an appellate podcast and just inviting all my friends on. And Blake Hawthorne, who's the clerk of our Texas Supreme Court, picked it up and said, oh, are you really interested in that? And I thought, not really. And then Todd said, no, seriously, are you interested? I kind of have always wanted to do that. So we talked on the phone and Todd has the tech side of it, which I certainly didn't have. And he had kind of explored the idea a few years ago, but realized it was more than one person could handle. And I definitely agreed with that. But we realized we kind of complemented each other in terms of what we bring to it. And so we just started doing it. And we started, I guess, fortuitously or not, in early March last year. Blake set us up. We went down to the Texas Supreme Court and got to interview him and Justice Jeff Boyd as our first two guests. And so we went and did that. And then the next week, the pandemic hit and everything shut down. And we were planning to record over Zoom anyway, because Todd's in Austin and I'm in Fort Worth. And then it turned out that now literally every judge in the state of Texas and the federal courts of appeals all know how to use Zoom, and they all have Zoom accounts. And so it's been really easy to get guests because they didn't have anywhere to go. They didn't have any excuses and they all have a Zoom account. We do it every week and it worked out really well to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's right. I had looked at it going back a few years ago and kind of saw a need and saw that, you know, there's definitely space to be filled with this kind of discussion. I'd started listening to legal podcasts, and the ones I liked the most were the ones in sort of this rather informal style, not a real stilted interview, you know, bright lights in the face kind of thing. Because of the way that social media and podcasting too has sort of opened people up to being more transparent and getting to know the people behind the bench or these successful appellate practices or the court clerks. And there's just such an opportunity. The medium kind of lends itself to, as we have said, pulling back the curtain, which is, I think, such an apt visual as far as what we really set out to do here. And the nice thing from our perspective is our courts are really in favor of that. And the folks who run them are really in favor of that. And Jody mentioned Blake Hawthorne, but it really was sort of fortuitous that we just all happened to be in this conversation. And when Jody made that Twitter post and Blake kind of amplified it, I thought, maybe I'll come back to that idea, because it really was the issue. I was, you know, I'm a sole practitioner and I really could not take on this kind of a thing by myself. And at first when we started, I really thought we would do more of a twice a month kind of thing, more or less on the schedule that y'all have done. But we started off and we're doing weekly episodes, and we just kind of got together and said, well, let's just see how this goes. And we just found ourselves with an abundance of topics and potential guests. And it just really hasn't stopped. It's not been a struggle for us to put together a weekly episode. It really doesn't take all that much time to get on a Zoom call. And as long as you spend a little time thinking about it in advance, kind of know what you want to talk about generally, it does tend to just kind of flow and happen. And then one of the things we did really early on was we went ahead and secured some sponsorship through a couple of companies that are known to the appellate world, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. And getting that support has allowed us to have the podcast kind of operate on its own with its own sort of budget and not having to deal with cost factors. And nobody's law firm was saying, hey, what are you spending this money on? What are you doing? Everybody's been very supportive. And so that's been great. And we've developed, I think I'm just kind of overwhelmed at the kind of following that we've developed. Last week, I think we hit 10,000 total downloads, which blows me away. But I can see now that having done this for about 10 months, the numbers are just increasing and they're starting to increase at a much faster rate. So we're not going to reach out and we're not going to be the most popular podcast on the internet. But we have a niche, and we do.
You don't think Joe Rogan is strategizing about how to combat the loss of listenership to the Texas Appellate Podcast?
I don't think anybody's really worried about us, but no, we've got a niche, and we have managed to have some really good guests come on, and it's been just a pleasure to do. I really enjoyed it. There are days that I would rather do this than, you know, my day job. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, we've all got bills to pay and you've got to take care of your clients. And so my background, just briefly, I was a 2-year postgraduate law clerk, briefing attorney at the Texas Supreme Court. And that's really what got me interested. I was already interested in appellate work, but going and seeing sort of how the sausage is made, Jana, really does give you that perspective. And I always joke around that I saw what people were doing when I was straight out of law school, and I thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And that's really turned out to be true in the end. I mean, I've managed to make a career out of it, and it's been a good career. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So it's kind of become, it was like when I first started blogging many years ago, that was kind of a novel thing, and people would come up and talk to me about it. And I was always thrilled when a judge would ask me about it. This has kind of taken the place of that. The podcasting is just such a different medium to consume. You can do it anywhere, but in your headphones. I think what y'all are doing is great as far as the case-specific stuff. I think we're going to have to think about whether that's something we want to do. But our approach has been, we'll just keep talking to people we know and are friends with. And eventually, maybe we'll run out of those people. And maybe we'll do some case updates or something on top of that. But I have found that new issues arise as the calendar goes from month to month. And so there's always going to be something of interest to talk about. But it's been fun for us to see what you guys are doing and check out your show and see you on Appellate Twitter, which, of course, is a great source of buzz for all of us, I think, and where we can meet our like-minded brothers and sisters and nerd out on this kind of stuff.
That's right. Well, in Oklahoma, I mean, we have an appellate practice section in our bar association, but it's really a very small community that truly focuses on appellate work primarily. I can count on one hand the people who truly have an appellate practice in Oklahoma. So it certainly is nice to reach across state lines through social media and be able to connect with folks who have a similar practice and a similar mindset about how they practice law and that kind of thing. So, and we sure do enjoy your guests and learning about the Texas court system for sure.
Well, I learned a lot about Oklahoma appellate procedure today, things that I did not know. And so it is very interesting to me. We've kind of come to the end of the time that we had scheduled. We always like to ask our guests if they've got a particular tip or war story to pass along. Do y'all have anything that you'd like to share with the Texas appellate lawyer contingent?
Well, I'll give you a tip, I guess, if you're thinking about taking an appeal in Oklahoma, and I briefly mentioned it earlier, Oklahoma in the district courts and at the appellate level does not have electronic filing. So if you are going to do an appeal in the Oklahoma Supreme Court, I would highly suggest you get a copy of the rules and figure out how to bind your briefs, how many copies you need to file with your original, because all of those things highly matter still in Oklahoma appellate practice. So that would be my practitioner's tip for you.
My tip is call Jana.
We have come to take electronic filing for granted in Texas, and it has saved our bacon.
Yeah. I mean, I can just imagine how much more efficient your practice is and easier, because I get appeals out of, for instance, Pittsburgh County, which is McAllister, which is 3 hours away from me, and I've got to have a certified copy of the final order. I have to have the paper record is actually put together in the court clerk's office and then mailed to the Supreme Court clerk. And so there's been times when we've had to make those trips and actually go down there and get some of those things if I wasn't, of course, the trial lawyer or involved in the trial in any way. And so I envy the efficiency that probably electronic filing allows you to have in parts of your practice.
And probably like Texas is probably the same, but as far as filing that petition in error, the timeliness of that is jurisdictional. So if you miss it by 1 minute, you're done. no appeal. So having to round all that stuff up and get it on file in time in Oklahoma City is sometimes challenging.
That I imagine that is. So make sure you have an Oklahoma City courier on standby if you're going to file something in the Oklahoma Supreme Court.
That's right. That is exactly right.
Don't wait till the day before and think you're going to just upload a PDF. It's not going to work.
Yep. Not going to happen in Oklahoma. So
I think the greater bit of wisdom coming out of this is worth consulting Oklahoma Appellate Counsel if Texas lawyers have appealed up in Oklahoma, because we are all used to electronic filing. And the advice of getting a copy of the rules, you'd like to think that's the starting point for everyone, but it's not always.
Mm-hmm. I know.
we didn't invite you guys on the show as a business development tool for y'all, but I'm happy. If anyone has an appeal in Oklahoma, you know, Jody Sanders has some experience with those, but I sure don't. And so I think calling you guys, Janet, Gabe, you know, I think would be a good first step.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. So,
well, with that, before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors. We've already mentioned them today, but we'll do it again. Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We really appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please send an email at hosts@texaplawpod.com, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at @texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.